Well, I wouldn't worry about who's giving the instructions. When you hear internal questions, like or internal instructions, like dropping into silence, or the little encouragements and the little reminders that we give ourselves, I wouldn't worry about who's giving the instructions. I just consider the instructions and think, are they worth applying or not? Does it count as good advice?
I kind of think, how do I apply them? Nice instructions, but how do I apply
them? Yeah. So the instructions that you were that you know you're giving yourself are dropping into the silence. Is that?
Yeah.
That's a lovely instruction. It's a beautiful reminder to just let go of all of the entanglements, all of the busyness, the agitation, and just drop in to the quiet that's already here, to the spaces between sounds, to the spaces between breaths, to dropping into the quietness, to the quietude of things. It's a beautiful reminder. And sometimes we pick up on little things and little attitudes or little ways of approaching things or instructions, and we just they stick somehow, and or we form them ourselves and they appear. So I think those ones, the ones that you said, seem like great instructions, and I go ahead and follow them. But you might sometimes hear an instruction that seems wacky, and then you have to use your wisdom, your discernment, to notice the difference. Just because a thought has appeared doesn't necessarily mean it's helpful. But those thoughts, I think you could think, oh, that's a helpful idea, and then rest into it. A lot of the meditation isn't a kind of a how to do in certain terms of a struggle to do. It's not like a really arduous sort of difficult to like physical labor kind of practice. A lot of the things of how we do things is just a way that we apply our mind, and we can apply our mind to something with a release. We can drop in to the experience of the present moment. We can rest back into the experience of a breath. We can also focus in on something, or we can notice, or we can observe. You know, there's different sort of ways that we approach the things, and having just a little hint of that is often enough for the mind to just hold its meditation object a little bit more appropriately given the present moment. Often we're a little bit too forceful with our object and backing off, not dulling out, but backing off so that we drop into it is really a lovely way of approaching. But sometimes we'll find that we're just a little bit passive about it, and we're just kind of just sitting here and everything's kind of going by. And what we really need is to sharpen the attention and to focus in on something and to make a decision to apply the attention to a specific object and stay there. You know, we need a little oomph sometimes. And so you sense for yourself whether you need a little bit more oomph or you've actually over-oomphed and you need to back off a little bit.
Usually I recognize the thoughts only after they pass. Sometimes I recognize it like in the middle. But after it passes, I'm okay, that was a thought, and it's helpful to kind of stabilize it. This was a thought about that, this was a thought. Considering that. But often it's like there's a whole story, and then it finishes, right? Oh, that was a big thought, long thought.
Well, you know, sometimes when we have a whole, you know, different thoughts, and you're right, we almost always become aware of the thought after it's passed, and so it's really another thought, it's another reflection to contemplate that thought that just passed. And so some approaches that we take at certain times in our practice, will be, it's gone. You know, it was like a split second ago, but it is totally gone now. And that we're really just coming back to the breath. And that's why it's really okay to drop a lot of thoughts. But it's skillful reflection is very helpful to once in a while turn and to look at that thought that just passed and to consider what kind of thought it was, how did the mind relate to it, what was the hook in it, what were the roots of it, the sources of that thought. But when I mean looking at the thought, I mean it takes that long, and then we're back with the body. Too often when we say look at the thought and reflect on the thought, people start having associative thinking about the thought and then judging themselves for having the thought and wondering how that conditioning occurred and where it came from and what it's going to lead to. And the mind just goes on and on and on about the thought, which is just being lost again. So when I refer to a kind of meditative investigation, I'm referring to something that does use the power of thought, but it uses it quite sharply, curtly, incisively, just seeing directly what's going on and recognizing what it is, but not thinking a long time about it. So you might think, whoa, big thought, which is basically really lost. That one really got me. And instead of then judging myself, oh, I'll never be able to meditate because it was a stupid thought and it still really got me in and in and in. We just said, wow. And there's a humility that comes, a humbling. How humbled we are by, I mean, how little control we have over our own minds. I mean, it's a little pathetic, isn't it? And when we realize how little control we have over our own minds, maybe that can give us a little bit more compassion about the people that we live with. They probably have just as little control over their minds. But why do we think that they should control themselves more than we can control ourselves? And so maybe we'll have a little bit more patience for our family, because if they don't meditate, then they may have even less control over their minds. And it's not to judge them for that, because we're pretty pathetic as it is. So we can just sort of see the pervasiveness of that. So there's a lot of times when it's like, whoa, big, you know, got caught, really got caught. And then see that. And sometimes you'll see, oh, got caught. And it was just desire. You know, it was, and then we might sometimes see, oh, got caught, but why did that desire catch me? Oh, and then we just look into the body and we'll realize, oh, well, there was a little uncomfortable sensation. And I didn't feel like paying attention to it. I wasn't open to the truth of the uncomfortable sensation. So I went off into this huge fantasy. And so you might sometimes see that there are certain things that either catch us into the thoughts or we get pulled into the thoughts because we're avoiding something else. And just in quickly looking at when you got into the thoughts and what pulled you in and how you come out, with a quick look, you might once in a while catch something that you'll learn, something very significant for yourself. Most of the time, it'll be as simple as that. Wow, big thought, come back, finished. Just start again with the breath. And being willing to start again, being willing to begin fresh, to let go of the past and just come into the present is very, very powerful in and of itself. So I like to work with thoughts once in a while, this investigation, and most of the time, just let them go and come back. And then again, once in a while, an investigation, short, and then come back. Did I sort of suggest it? Okay. Please. Oh, you have good thoughts.
Okay, maybe there's not a crucial thought. I don't know. But sometimes you feel something very important.
Or maybe
say, okay, I let it go. I come back to my breathing, and after maybe 2 seconds, it's coming back. You leave it for this session, but it comes back after 2 o'clock.
It's a good point, because sometimes, now, you know, really most of our thoughts are not very crucial. Most of them are not. And every once in a while, we'll get an important thought or a good idea. And sometimes we'll just jot it down after the meditation. Like we'll just think, oh, you know, I actually want to remember that. And I don't want to keep rehearsing it in my mind so that I remember it. So we just go and we get one of those little slips of paper and we write three or four words so that we'll remember it at the end of the retreat and then can deal with it then. Like if there's a planning thought or if there's something that you need to do or there's something that you need to tell somebody or there's something that you just want to remember or you have an insight. You know, you don't want to start doing it then or you don't want to start writing a big page about it. But a few words can sometimes just say, okay, this is something that's important enough that I want to deal with. I want to do something about it in my life, whether it's to reflect upon it more or communicate something. And so you just jot a note so that you can take care of it at a different time. That's one way, and that often will help set things aside a little bit. But there will be once in a great while, and not on every retreat, once in a great while, there'll be a thought that we'll realize, oh, this actually is worth some reflection, some conscious reflection. And then, you know, maybe there's a dilemma or a decision we're trying to make in our life, a dilemma that we're facing, or something that we just need to consider. And then we might want to take some time in the quietness to actually reflect upon it, to give quality thought to it. And I think that is okay to do, but we do it very, very rarely because most of our thoughts we just set aside because most of them are really habitual. But if you do come up to one of those, they're often decision-making things, you know, that you feel like, then I would recommend doing setting it aside a lot of the time because so much of the quality decisions really come out of the silence, out of that inner stillness where we're in touch with our deepest aspirations and our intentions. And when we're in touch with our deepest intentions, then we'll have the courage to overcome difficulties. We'll have the courage to make a decision not based on fear, but based on an alignment with those intentions. So we won't be making a decision out of desire and wanting something or out of fear, avoiding something. We'll be making a decision out of that intention. So we kind of clear away all the thoughts again and again and again and again and again. And then when the mind is quiet and sustained in some quiet for some time, then you might intentionally say, okay, I invite that thought in. I invite that dilemma in. And then see what arises. And when I do this, I usually like to spend the time in the meditation hall just clearing out, letting go, just developing a focus on the meditation object. And then I might take maybe 30 minutes after a lunch period or at dinner time or something and just go sit under a tree. And maybe have some paper and pen in case I wanted to write something down. And maybe even pose a question to myself. The underlying question that keeps bringing that issue back, which is often a very simple question like, what do I really want? You know, or what's important here? Or, something, it's usually a very basic question. And then just listen. You know, instead of just start writing, just listen to see what's your response to that. And jot a word or two down that you feel has a response to that. And then you might just sit quiet again until another question emerges. Oh, how do I feel about that? And you go with very, very basic questions. Oh, I feel very nervous about that. I feel like I'll never be able to do that. Or I feel like that's really exciting. I feel ready. Or I feel numb, you know, just whatever you feel. And then set it aside and go back to the quiet and just feel the body sitting and breathing. So you integrate a kind of a reflective process with the silence. And I found when I've done something like that, I'm usually conscious about the thought process and feel pretty good about the decisions that come out of it. But it usually takes a whole lot of letting go of the habitual thoughts before I can actually get there. in the meditation hall. Oh, it's been years since I've had a thought worth thinking in the meditation hall. I mean, truly, truly. Because that would have to be a thought that would have to be more important than what was happening in the present moment. And I'm trying to think of what it might be. So use this kind of reflection very sparingly.
Is there a word in Pali that you're translating as spiritual?
Oh, no, there really isn't. Oh, but Karen, is there any word in Pali? There isn't that one finds as spiritual? Oh, the not carnal, like the happiness sutta that I was talking about the other day. Yes. The way that I've been using it, so that's in the context of the other day when I was talking about a kind of happiness that's carnal or physical or sensual pleasure, and then the kind of happiness that comes in the meditative experience or the spiritual life, and the kind of happiness that comes with the release, with something beyond, something of an ultimate realization.
I go blank when anybody says the spiritual life, the spiritual path, and I fumble around inwardly thinking I want common ground with what they're saying, but I won't use that word, yeah. I won't use that word talking.
Probably a better, you know, it's the spiritual life is not a really good term in Buddhism. There are references to what's called the holy life, but I'm not sure that's totally any bet. That's much better in English.
That's easier for me because, like I know from Hebrew, that would be to do with separating myself in some way.
What's the holy life in Pali? Holy life. The holy life is to be lived, the holy life, one undertakes the holy life. Sometimes people don't, you know, they avoid the term spiritual and they prefer to just say, the Dhamma, you know, just knowing the Dhamma, knowing things as they are, knowing the truth of things, knowing the teachings, knowing the way. And sometimes when I use the term just casually, because the spiritual life is just something I commonly hear at home. It's a way of crossing over all religious disciplines and just saying something other than, something of a realization that takes us beyond my life, my family, my car, my house, my work, my identity, my, and my. And then that something other than that, when I'm saying, you know, the spiritual life, that's more or less what I'm referring to, is whatever that is. But you're right, it's not a very accurate term because it doesn't really refer to anything, and the way that I was using it isn't the way that it's used in that context in the Pali.
Mindfulness is better. Another translation in Hebrew,
mindfulness.
Chutni tsumat lev, yesh od mashu, mudaut.
We'll also say awareness in English sometimes. One of the lovely things about mindfulness, I've been in the last year or so, doing a little bit more study of the Abhidhamma, and it's interesting to consider some of these factors, like mindfulness, and how one of the beautiful things about mindfulness is it's a wholesome factor. You know, it's an entirely wholesome factor. It isn't the same as just attention, where you can be attentive to something. You can put your attention on anything. When you're mindful of something, it implies that there is a state of mind associated with mindfulness that is wholesome, you know, that has the qualities that incline towards an understanding or a wisdom or a clear seeing. It is inclined that way. So mindfulness is a sati, is a very lovely kind of factor that we develop. Oh, and manasikara is the wise use of the mind. So, or manasikara is the attention. That's usually translated as attention, which is more neutral.
How do we work with emotions, especially if they seem to stick for a while?
Yeah.
They don't. Is it the same as we work with the thoughts?
Okay, the question is how to work with emotions, especially if they stick for a while, and is it the same as working with thoughts?
And if it's appropriate, maybe you can expand about the relationship between thoughts and emotions.
Okay. Do you have any favorite emotions these days? We experience them all at one time or another, but what's up?
Fear.
Fear is a good one. Fear is a commonly arises. So, actually, when we work with emotions and thoughts, we work with them in a very similar way. Very, very, very similarly. And they're often intertwined. I mean, you don't experience a thought without an emotion. We don't experience an emotion without, there's some subtle kind of, there can even be subtle thoughts related to it. But they're basically classified as a mental object, as simple as that. And so they're dealt with the same. They're a mental object. And we become aware of this mental experience. It's not of the body so much, it's of the mind. There's a mental object. Emotions will have different roots, same as thoughts will arise out of different roots. The mental objects will be rooted in greed, rooted in anger, or rooted in delusion as the three primary unwholesome roots, and their opposites would be the wholesome. So when you sense fear, you're really sensing something, a manifestation of aversion or ill will. It's that not wanting what's happening. So sometimes it moves in an aggressive response, like an anger, and sometimes it moves in a withdrawal response, which might be fear. And if there's a disposition towards fear, then we might have that become more chronic, and it can create a kind of anxiety or a kind of underlying insecurity, a kind of just fear that underlies our experience. And then that can affect and influence how we experience the next moment of contact, or the next moment of contact, or the next moment of experience. So when you recognize that fear has arisen, you work with it the same way that you work with anything. You bring your attention to it and become mindful of it. Oh, what is this? What is this? And that curiosity to actually know what fear is lets us feel it in the body. And so we investigate, how does it manifest in the body? Does it make the stomach quiver? Does it make the knees shake? Does it make do we feel cold? Do we feel heat? Do we feel contracted? Do we feel relaxed? How do we feel in the body? And does it spark any particular thought trains, any proliferation of thoughts in Pali Papancha? Because if we're not aware of the fear, then we can often go into prapancha, and that's a Pali term that's usually translated as conceptual proliferation. And fear can very often go into planning, you know, because we're afraid of how we'll act, and we might try to protect ourselves by planning what we will do and what we will say and how we will act and how we will prepare and da-da-da, you know, all of those things. So we can start to see that the mental state of fear is also linked with and supports these thoughts of planning, and planning continues to fuel the re-arising of this fear and starts to get into this cycle. So just by being mindful of the process, we just learn something about our own relationship to fear, and we become willing to feel it. And so then we drop back into the body and we say, can I be with this now? Oh, this is fear. And can I know the fear? Okay, the fear is this way and it's this way, and I feel it like this, and it sparks that thought. And now I feel the fear quivering, it's increasing, it's decreasing, it's like this. And we just explore the fear for some moments. And it passes. All moods, emotions, mental states, they arise and they pass. So we recognize it. And then instead of creating, see what the untrained mind does is it creates a, in addition to the experiencing of the fear, then we decide, I am a fearful person. And so then we have this burdensome concept that we've just overlaid upon us and now was going to carry us into the next moment and the next life. And we think that we've learned something about ourselves because now we've discovered that we're fearful. But this is not Buddhist. This is not the insight that we come to. Instead, we don't lay upon the concept of that burdensome fear. We don't attribute concept to it. We break it down to see all its parts in the body, in the mind, moment by moment, coming and going, and how we're responding to it, how sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant. And we see that it's just this cluster of experiences that are arising due to causes, due to conditions. And they change and they end. And then we come, and then we're left with sitting and breathing. You know, we're just sitting here as it is. Can I be with that now too? And so the insight that starts to come isn't a personal insight in the sense that I am like this. It's the opposite. It's that this just arises. It has these causes. It arises due to causes. It has these effects. And it passes. And then there's sitting and breathing, aware of sitting and breathing. Something else arises. It's known. And it passes. And we're still sitting and breathing, and something else arises. And we start to realize that life is just pulsing through with these momentary events that occur and disappear and arise and pass and happen and vanish, and that life is all of these momentary experiences that occur again and again. And somewhere along the line, it dawns on us, I am not any of it. None of this is me. None of it is mine. There is no place that I can fix and hold and say, that's me. In all of this flow of changing experiences, fear and planning and hope and delight and pleasure and a decision that we have to make and a feeling of pain in the knee and hunger in the stomach and the desire, it's just all arising and passing due to causes and conditions. And it's just seeing that fluid nature of all things unravels that tendency to get stuck at any particular place. Because when we're stuck, getting stuck is the same as I am this. This is mine. There's a grasping. And so we start to release that grasping and that tendency to grasp. And then it's just fear that flows through, and we're not afraid. It's just fear that comes due to conditions, and it passes. And we don't have to act on the fear, and the fear doesn't stop us from acting. It's just felt as it flows through. Well, we're approaching the lunchtime, and we seem to have a sunny day today. So you might enjoy some standing meditation at some point after the lunch, or enjoy the day as it is.